Shonk with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hello and welcome to the 99th episode of Robots. My name is Jana, and today we will be visiting the 5th International Shunk Expert Days on Service Robotics with Amanda. But first, let's get the latest news and developments in robotics with Christine.
Thank you. On March 1st, 2012, Nevada became the first state worldwide to introduce an official procedure for allowing autonomous cars to enter normal traffic. A series of path-breaking new legal provisions now allow robot cars, such as those developed by Google, Volkswagen, Volvo, and many university labs, to be tested on the same streets and highways as human drivers, with only a red license plate marking them as robots. This red plate will eventually be replaced by a neon green license plate for autonomous robot cars that have proven their worth. By providing a legal framework that clears what many experts perceive as the biggest hurdle in making autonomous cars become a reality, the new Nevada legislation not only marks a very important milestone, it also sets a precedent for other U.S. states. And in fact, three more states, Hawaii, Florida, and Oklahoma, are currently considering introducing similar legislation. In other news, U.S. company Boston Dynamics has released the first video of its cheetah robot, which you may remember from previous news, breaking the speed record for legged robots by running at speeds faster than 18 miles per hour or 30 kilometers per hour. The cheetah uses flexible legs that provide it with the fast reaction time necessary to follow the terrain at such speed. The video shows the record-breaking performance with cheetah powered by an external hydraulic pump sprinting on a treadmill, both of which is expected to shed over the course of the year. For more news as well as videos of Boston Dynamics cheetah robot, have a look at www.robotspodcast.com.
The International Shunk Expert Days are now in their fifth year, and our reporter Amanda was invited to attend the event held in Hausen, Germany last week. World-class speakers gathered at the Expert Days to discuss the opportunities and possibilities of service robotics. During the conference, Bruno Siciliano, Professor of Control and Robotics and Director of the Prisma Lab at the University of Naples, Federico II, gave a talk on grasping and control of multi-fingered hands. Amanda went to speak to him at the event to find out more.
Hi, Bruno, and welcome to Robots.
Thanks. It's nice to be with Rob the podcast. You know, I was aware of this project, and it's really cool. You know, I was just browsing on the website, and I found some really cool stuff, and it's nice to be part of the project now.
Well, thank you very much. So let's start off with a couple of questions. So in the course of your career, you have touched on almost all domains of robotics research. Currently, you are the coordinator of DexSmart, which is a European project on dexterous and autonomous dual-hand manipulation. So what is it about manipulation that stands out with respect to other robotics research?
Yes, DexSmart was a four-year project, which actually just ended January 31st. These days I'm under pressure with the final reporting, so this is the week of the deadlines. Anyway, yeah, manipulation is very challenging in the sense that currently, you know, if we look at what is available with the current state of the art in robotics technology, we're not there yet. You know, this morning there was a fascinating presentation by Professor Makoto Kaneko from Osaka University. And he was really emphasizing how difficult, how complex it is to achieve dexterous manipulation. Right. So what we tried to do in DexSmart was to merge some new technology work on the use of smart materials for actuators and sensors on one hand. And on the other hand, we tried to merge the cognitive aspects of manipulation into the technology. Mm-hmm. So this is typical in a so-called integrated project, you know, at European level, in which you really have to merge different skills from different communities. People working on learning from observation, like we heard this morning from Rüdiger Dillmann at the in his presentation. At the same time, you also want to advance the technology, because one limitation of most dexterous hands is the miniaturization of sensors and actuators into the fingers. So, I mean, the Dexmart was a big challenge. Of course, after 4 years, we haven't solved all the problems of manipulation, but at least we were showing the feasibility of achieving some dexterous actions in which we learn the motion directly from human, thanks to the cognitive component of the project.
Right, right. So maybe in the same line of thought, let's talk a bit about compliance. So
yeah,
the formal definition of compliance is very short. It's the inverse of stiffness.
Yes.
Now, you have illustrated this concept really nicely with a Chapley move in Modern Times. I don't know if you remember that.
Yes, of course, yes.
And that is beautiful, but I think that compliance, how we see it today as a problem in robotics, has gone a long way from that.
Yes, actually, I have a background in control, and I've always looked at compliance from an active viewpoint. Basically, industrial robots were traditionally made stiff, because stiffness was a synonym of precision and accuracy. And it was the role of the control people to provide stiff system, rigid system, with the capability of interacting with environment, and then you need compliance. Mm-hmm. But there is a new trend in robotic research, and the trend is to combine the compliance as possible with control, with compliance in the design. And there are people looking at so-called variable stiffness actuators, variable impedance actuators, mm-hmm. which in a way they try to resemble the actuation of the human arms, mm-hmm. which we have the bones, which you may consider are rigid, a certain level of approximation, but you also have the muscles and the tendons. So our, once again, and this is always the case in robotics, the human model is the excellent model to imitate. And so people looking at variable stiffness and variable impedance actuators are trying to modify the conventional design and to have an actuator which is stiff when it needs to be stiff and accurate, at the same time is compliant when it's in contact with the environment, because then it's when the safety aspects and the dependability aspects of the interaction come into play.
So if I listen to you here, and then I think of Professor Kaneko's presentation this morning where he talked about superhuman performance,
yeah.
Do I see this kind of orthogonality in the approach of, you know, on one side we have superhuman, stiff, super fast actuation, and then on the other side we have something which has to be a little bit more cognitive, a little bit more compliant. Do you think this can be combined, or is this really two orthogonal directions?
No, I think, you know, right now they are still orthogonal. I mean, it's like... The current state of the art is like people working on the cognitive aspects, they are not really concerned about what technology can provide. But as Professor Kaneko showed, I mean, the technology doesn't need to be necessarily complex. Could be also sort of simple, could also be minimalistic. You know, you can do more with the two conventional grippers than with the dexterous hand.
Yeah.
So basically, I think what is missing, you know, in the, and it's not because we're not, I mean, the field is not ripe yet. What is missing is a sort of kind of synergetic approach in which the designers would sit together with the people working on cognitive science. And for instance, there was also another presentation about machine learning. These days, machine learning is so popular, is so important. To be able to embed machine learning not just in the use phase of a robotic system, mm-hmm. but this needs to be embedded into the design phase, and only then probably we will be able to combine, and this sort of fertilization between the two areas will happen and will contribute to design new grippers and new systems. But right now there is a deep gap. When I started working on the proposal for the Dexmart project, for instance, I contacted some companies like Schunk, they have a tradition about grippers, about hands and KUKA. And the answer was that it's too early.
Yeah.
I mean, we can be observers to your project, but the field is not yet there. Mm. And also, even the shunk anthropomorphic hand or the Barrett hand, they have a forbidden cost. It's like 90, you know, from 50,000 up. Mm-hmm. So how can you justify the use of such hand into a conventional application? Right. So I think we really need to completely rethink the design of, it doesn't have to be necessarily like anthropomorphic or like dextrous, could be even simpler. But then it's in the design stage where some concepts have to be revisited, and I think now the field is feeling this sort of need, and so you know the dream is that at a certain point the design will be revisited, and in a way where. I mean, if the sensor technology is so powerful, and as Professor Kaneko showed, you know, what you can do is really beyond the you know what humans can do, then why not to exploit it also already in the design stage? Mm-hmm. And so why should we have, like, for instance, so many degrees of freedom? Tomorrow I will be speaking about the use of postural synergies, which was another result that we have in the DEXMAR project. Mm-hmm. And actually, you know, the hand is so complex with 30 or 40 degrees of freedom, depending on what kind of how accurate is your kinematic model. But actually, if you look at the postural synergies, the movements that the human hands do are quite simple. And with three basic movements, three basic equivalent degrees of freedom, you can describe most of the manipulation and grasping actions that we do daily unconsciously. So I mean, it's the challenge. Do I attempt to control 40 degrees of freedom, or do I concentrate directly? I mean, I think unconsciously, we don't even realize that we have so many degrees of freedom, but we make movements in a much more intuitive fashion. So I mean, there is a gap because the mechatronics does not correspond to our cognitive function that we have learned, you know, since we were kids, and then we try to manipulate, you know, object in a dexterous way, but we are not really exploiting, you know, all the degrees of freedom as such, you know, from a traditional mechanical viewpoint. So I think it's like going this direction will contribute to improve the performance of dexterous, we say dexterous hands, but could be like end effector grippers. And maybe someday, you know, and then that's when there's a challenge also to decrease the cost.
Right.
But we're not there yet. So
brilliant.
That's the problem. Yeah.
Okay, so let me change the subject a little bit. So you've been a major player within the IEEE community for the past several years.
Yeah.
What would you say is the IEEE's main role in robotics?
Well, IEEE has a kind of, well-known background and also respect and visibility into the scientific community. And the Robotics Innovation Society is one of the, I think it's more than 40 societies and councils. Initially, when I decided to, I mean, I got interested to IEEE because I was trying to publish papers in their, you know, in their journals, in transactions that have a good reputation. But then I discovered there was a value behind the journals and the conferences. And the value is a kind of service to the community. I mean, it's my involvement, like many others, volunteers, it's only based because you believe into the added value of a community, and also the value that this community may represent for outreaching other communities. So if you take a look at a typical table of contents of an IEEE journal or conference proceedings like 20 years ago, they were mainly like robotics papers. If you take a look at table of contents now, it's so interdisciplinary. And in a way, IEEE is a sort of, the way I see it, is a sort of guarantee that this kind of cross-fertilization among different areas, which is happening very much in robotics, you know, happens, because there is a respectable community of people working on, for instance, on control, because I have background in control, and there are people working in control that they got interested to robotics, and people working on networks, people working on biomedical applications. So I think the real power of IEEE is to have this kind of container for a big portion of ICT, in terms of information communication technology, and also like favoring the interaction across different societies and different communities. And I think, in robotics now, we have 50 years of robotics. I think the field is well assessed. I think now it's the time for outreaching. And I found a service provided by IEEE to go in that direction. So that's, the motivation for me to be a volunteer, an active member of the community.
Indeed, yeah. But one does realize that IEEE guarantees continuity when one goes to ICRA and IROS, and you see that there are thousands of people there.
Exactly.
And it's all coming together.
Yeah, that's the alter ego is the opposite of a topical meeting like where we are today, because single track events are ideal because, in 2 or 3 days you get to talk to almost everybody. And sometimes I wonder what's the value of maybe sending your PhD students to a big conference like ICRA or IROS. I think the value is just the opportunity to open up your mind, because there are so many different, sometimes even difficult to make a choice which session, which workshop, which tutorial you want to attend. But I think that's the value. It's really the opportunity to, and also it's especially for the young PhD students like you, it's also an opportunity to do the networking and to keep the contacts with PhD students from other countries and also from other fields that where robotics is the common ground.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, so my final question. So you're also a member of EU Robotics. So what do you think is the importance of communicating robots to the public?
Yes, EU Robotics, first of all, I have to say that, came at the junction between the academic community in Europe, which was well recognized also internationally, like EURON, and the industrial component, which is the European Robotic Technology Platform, Europe. And so we gave birth to EU Robotics, and so next week there will be the forum in Odense in Denmark, and this is now the third edition of a forum in which there is a massive participation of both components, academia and industry. Now, what is the role of this coordination action? It's just the providing networking opportunities to the European community, and for instance, within EuRobotics, we launched a major event this year, which was the European Robotics Week, which took place around the end of November, beginning of December. There were a number of, I think there were like more than 300 events organized and hosted in parallel in the various robotics labs in Europe. It could be in the form of open house, could be some kind of demonstration and workshops. And as you said, the added value of an event was like this, was to reach out the common public. Because as long as we are within experts, we have a more or less clear notion of what a robot is and what is the challenge for robotics. But the people from outside, they don't realize it. For instance, if you go to Wikipedia, you see that only 5% of the images, of the pictures of robots represented in Wikipedia are from Europe. And most of them are from Japan. Why is that? Because typically the media, they find the humanoid or the biologically inspired zoomorphic robots to be kind of more capturing the news and the audience than maybe some good solid mechatronic design, which doesn't necessarily have the aspect of an animal or of a human, like a humanoid. And I think that we have to change this perception, because I think that the notion of a robot is a sort of evolving concept, and of course the model to imitate. Ultimately, we want to have a sort of automa looking like a human being, but I think the the ways is very long, and I think we need both this kind of kind of high risk research of people working with humanoids, with biologically inspired systems, but also we need that the industry little by little. Now, they got interested to service robotics, and this is clear. And I think, the people should realize that there is a way to go, and we have to change the typical notion that the public have about robots, because normally people think it's a negative thing, because I want to interact with the human. But take, like some example, like rehabilitation, like, for instance, like caregivers. I think there are fields where the use of a machine would provide more reliable and a better service to the humans, and this is the positive side of robotics, that in initiatives like the Eurobotics and the Forum and the Robotics Week, we are trying to send out this message. And of course, there's a lot more that needs to be done. And also, it's important that, for instance, at the forum next week, as well as other occasions, the media also take part to the event, not only in the form of just coming and interviewing like one or two people, but also, to give them the opportunity to see that, how the field is progressing and what are the challenges beyond the attraction of what could be like a humanoid or a zoomorphic robot that, always makes the news in European media.
Well, brilliant. Thank you very much, Bruno, for joining us.
Pleasure.
Rolf Pfeiffer is a member of the Robots Podcast Advisory Board and directs the AI Lab at the University of Zurich. He is also the Deputy Director of the National Competence Center for Research in Robotics in Switzerland. He's one of the founders of AI, with research interests in the areas of embodiment, biorobotics, artificial evolution, modular robotics, and many more. During the conference, he gave a talk on soft robotics, challenges and opportunities. He also met up with Amanda to give us a bit more of an insight into this area of research.
Hi, Rolf, and welcome to Robots.
Hi, thank you.
Okay, so your research is guided by the vision Understanding by Building. How do you implement this vision in practice?
Okay, so we try to look at biological systems, be it animals or humans, and then we have some phenomenon that we're interested in, like how ants find their way to the nest, how we recognize a face in a crowd, how people walk up and down the stairs while carrying a bag or something, and then we try to build a system which mimics this capability as well.
Okay. So this morning we saw a talk by Professor Koneko, where he actually posed a very interesting question in his talk. He said, well, if we want amazing grippers, then maybe what we should do is, well, our goal should be not to aim for human-like or for mimicking human artifacts, but rather to shoot for things that are way beyond, so superhuman, for instance, by exploiting high-speed vision or high-speed actuation. So, I mean, with this vision in our mind, how does your research strategy respond to that?
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think it depends very much on what your goals are, what the goals of your research are. If your goal is, among other things, to understand biological systems, then I think, it's a good strategy to use the Understanding by Building. Now, if your goal is to get things done, then often, humans, they can do many things. But as Makoto was explaining this morning, there are many things that machines do far better than human beings. Actually, in most sensory motor tasks, some machine will be superior to a human. So, of course, we can then ask ourselves, does it make sense to actually make a copy of a human being that can do then, like we, many things, but nothing really well? And so I would fully agree with him that if we want to get a task done, maybe it's not always a good idea to try and copy how humans would do it. You know, take, for example, a screwdriver and how we drive a screw. I mean, it's about the most stupid way in which you can do it. It's much better if you have something that turns 360 degrees in the same direction. So, and also, I mean, we do have technology, and we do develop technology, among other things, because technology can do things better than we can. So I don't see a conflict there at all. What I still would like to say is that by studying biological system, by studying what evolution has come up with, we can get inspiration for principles. One example, it seems that evolution has endowed its beings, its creations, with high energy efficiency. And so if we understand the principles that nature is using to get high, especially for autonomous systems, this is really important, to get high energy efficiency, then we can transfer part of that, part of the principles, to an artificial system. But then we can still use, for example, other types of sensors. We can use other types of materials, other types of technologies. But, for example, the exploitation of passive dynamics, as we say in the jargon, is, you know, like when we walk, the leg swings almost passively forward, which of course is very energy efficient. And we also, in more sophisticated technological systems, would maybe like to exploit these phenomena to achieve higher efficiency. So, but then we can go beyond and use better materials, for example.
Absolutely. So what you're saying is actually you can try to decouple the actual task that the human is trying to solve by using its very efficient or whatever mechanisms and inspire yourselves from these to a different, completely different task eventually, but by actually observing these phenomena.
By observing the biological system, and then we don't need, I mean, if I have a manufacturing task, or he was giving some, you know, brilliant examples like packing a hamburger into a box, into one of these bento lunch boxes, then we don't need a full humanoid robot, but we just need a mechanism for placing the hamburger in the right place into the box without hurting the hamburger.
Yeah, absolutely. okay, so I just have one more last question. So in our special issue celebrating 50 years of robotics, almost 2 years ago, we asked you to make a prediction about the future of robotics. And one of the things you said was notably that the term robotics would disappear. So what would you say today?
Okay, well, I would say the term has not disappeared. What I do think is that we will get used to these machines that move in the environment. And whether you actually want to use the term robot for, let's say, one of these vacuum cleaners, one of these Roombas, I mean, that's basically up to you. You want to call it a machine, you want to call it a robot. What I do think is that we will have more and more technology. And, for example, what we just heard before, a talk on ambient intelligence. And I think robots will cooperate with the ambient intelligence, and maybe they will not be full-fledged, you know, kind of humanoids with lots of sensing and actuation, but maybe specialized machines. But they will be able to achieve their task because they cooperate with their environments. So I think I would still say, conceptually, maybe the term robot, even if we still keep using the term conceptually, I think it will just be technology in the environment that will do good things for us and make our lives easier.
Indeed. I actually have the feeling that the term robot and robotics is starting to become a bit outdated.
Yes, I think you could probably say that. And I think if you want predictions, you know, there are basically two scenarios that people are looking at, or maybe combinations of scenarios. One is really the robot companion, especially in Japan. This is popular, but now also in Europe, you know, with these flagships where there is one robot companion flagship proposal. And the other scenario, and then, in the robot companion scenario, you would have one robot that can do all these many things, but really nothing very well. Mm-hmm. And in the other scenario, you would have lots of sort of an environment with a lot of technology with more specialized machines, but these specialized machines, because they're specialized for specific tasks, will be more efficient and, you know, better at these specific tasks. Now, which of these scenarios, or whether a combination of these, will materialize in the future, I think is still out in the open.
Okay, so on this note, thank you very much, Rolf, for joining us.
Okay, thank you very much.
And that concludes our 99th episode. We hope you enjoyed this visit to the Schunk Expert Days. As always, more information is available on our website at robotspodcast.com. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time with our 100th episode. Goodbye. Schunk with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.